Division personnel. I'd like to first start out with the introductions of the RAC committee. We'll start over here with Christine and come this way.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Larry Fitzgerald, agriculture.
George Garcia, Forest Service.
Alan White, agriculture.
Chris Marble, at large.
Ben Lauder, at large.
Carl Hurst, sportsman.
Ken Strong, sportsman.
Matt Clark, sportsman.
Mike Gates, BLM.
Okay. I'm Richard Hansen. I'm the RAC chair. And Jason Vernon is the director of the Central Region. He keeps us all straight, I think. Just to explain how the meeting will be conducted, the division will make some recommendations and a presentation. After that point, then we will bring it to the RAC for any questions on that presentation. Then the public will be given an opportunity to ask questions. And we want to ask every one of you, including the RAC, to make sure and speak into the mic so this is being recorded. Scott's subbing for our secretary this time. And so we need to have that recorded. Then after the public has their opportunity to ask questions, then there will be a comment period. If you have comments, please fill out one of these cards and give it up to us, and we can call you to the mic, and you can present your comments at that point. After that's done, then it'll bring it back to the RAC for any comments and any motions that they or any other business concerning that presentation they'd like to discuss. So the Wildlife Board was postponed, and so there hasn't been a Wildlife Board since our last RAC meeting, so there's nothing to report there. We'll do that next time. So we want to recognize John Baer, of the chairman of the Wildlife Board. Thank you, John, for being here. So with that, I'd first like to take a motion, and if you've had a chance to look at the meetings of the last meeting, and if they're correct, I'll entertain a motion on that, on the last meetings. Okay, Carl has a motion. Any second? Okay, second here. Okay. Now the agenda, the approval of the. I guess better vote, haven't we? Okay, all in favor of that motion? Okay, voting is unanimous. Okay, the tonight's agenda. I'll entertain a motion on the agenda. If there's any changes or corrections that you see you need to make. Okay, Ken, motion to approve the agenda. Have a second. Okay, so we will have to do that. Okay, second, Carl. Okay, all in favor? Okay, voting is unanimous on that. Okay, we'll turn the time over to Jason for a regional update.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't seem like it's been that long since we met before. I don't have a lot of updates. A couple of kind of hot topics that I'll cover just really briefly so we can get into the meat of the agenda today. In our outreach section, we're going to be holding quite a few ice fishing events coming up this winter. I think I've got about 8 of them listed here. The one that's coming up most currently, I guess, is December 16th. That'll be at Sportsman's Warehouse up in Midvale. And then we've got quite a few other things, some fishing events up at Strawberry Reservoir. There's some dates on those that can be found on our website as well as on our Facebook. We'll be promoting those quite a bit. So be sure if you're interested in ice fishing, haven't had a chance to do that, there's lots of opportunity to learn that. One other thing for our outreach section, kind of a popular event down in San Pete County is Bald Eagle Day. It'll be held February 11th, and that's kind of a staging area near the Fountain Green Fish Hatchery. And from there, you travel south, maybe a mile down the road, and there's a big old cottonwood tree there that's the bald eagles like to fly into that and sit in that tree, and there's a great parking spot there where we can view those bald eagles. So if you haven't had a chance to do that, I'd invite you to go down there on February 11th. Our wildlife section, right now they're really busy doing some big game captures. The last couple of days they've spent a lot of time capturing deer, looking at the overall condition of the deer. These are collared deer that were caught last year and collars put on. They're catching them again this year, taking their condition measurements. They'll capture these same deer again in March and look at their condition from now to then to see how they're doing. We've also got some elk captures coming up in February, bighorn sheep in January, and moose captures in January as well. So a lot of helicopter time coming up for our biologists. Law enforcement, hunts are over. Most of the big game hunts are over. They're still working waterfowl. They're also actively patrolling our winter ranges, looking for violations on our winter ranges. Habitat, kind of the same story. They're just finishing their restoration projects and their fire rehabilitation projects, trying to beat the snow. They're doing a lot of helicopter and fixed wing work, getting seed on and then getting that seed in the ground with chains and drills. So hopefully they'll get that finished up within the next couple of weeks. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the highlights of what we've got coming up and what we've done over the last month. So I'll turn the time back over to you.
Okay. Thanks, Jason. Okay, we'll go to the first action item on the agenda. It's the waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments. Blair Stringham, our waterfowl program coordinator.
Yeah. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tonight I'll be presenting the 2017-18 waterfowl hunting recommendations, so this will be next season. What I wanted to go through first is just an overall summary of habitat conditions last year and this year. For the most part, the Prairie Paul region, where most of our waterfowl come from and up through Alaska, has been pretty good conditions overall. We saw this year a little bit of drier conditions through Alberta, which really kind of affects us. That's where a lot of our birds come from. But overall, for the most part, waterfowl breeding conditions continue to look well across Canada and Alaska. And in terms of how that affects waterfowl populations, our North American breeding duck population counts we do each year continue to report back with record levels. We're a little bit lower from where we were last year, but still really at all-time highs as far as since we started doing these surveys. So duck populations are doing really good. Looking a little bit closer at some of the species-specific stuff, compared to last year, most duck species stayed about where they were. We did see some small increases and decreases with widgeon, shoveler, and scop, and as well as some larger decreases with pintails. For the most part, all of our waterfowl species are staying above their long-term average, with the exception of pintails, which have been down for quite some time now. The way our waterfowl or our duck recommendations are formulated are based on our western population of mallards. This year, we again had a really robust population of mallards, and so we'll be able to offer the most liberal package available from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a 107-day season with a bag limit of 7. And for our three species that have species-specific harvest strategies associated with them, those stay the same except for pintail. They'll be going from 2 birds down to 1 bird bag, which is a pretty big deal here because we do have a lot of pintails that move through, but overall their population has been down, which puts us below a threshold where we can offer a 2-bird bag. For the rest of our waterfowl species, swans continue to do well. They've been hanging about 90 to 100,000 swans for 30 or 40 years now. Our Canada goose population, both locally and across the continent, has continued to increase each year. as well as our light geese, our snow and Ross geese populations. They've continued to increase as well. So overall, most waterfowl are doing really well across North America. So getting to our recommendations, for several years now, there's been a growing interest from waterfowl hunters in the southern part of the state to do a southern waterfowl zone like we had about 10 years ago. As we've looked at this, we found that there's a lot of opportunities that would be available if we did do that. It would provide for longer seasons. We'd start a season in the northern part of the state and then start a season in the southern part of the state a little bit later, which would give duck hunters a week or two longer to hunt ducks in the state if they're a little bit more mobile. It will also allow us to provide 2 youth days and 2 general openers in the state, which are really popular with hunters, as well as we've been looking for ways to try to provide more opportunity for our youth, and so this would be a way to have a second day for them as well to participate in waterfowl hunting with just the youth and no adults. And we have been seeing trends in the southern part of the state that have also led to reduced harvest the first part of the season. As things have been warmer the last decade or so, we're seeing fewer and fewer birds move south as early as they used to. And so this would provide better hunting by moving the season back, and our late season hunting would definitely be better down the southern part of the state. This also allows us to have a scop season that's split between the northern and southern parts of the state, so we could actually provide scop hunting until about the end of January, which has been really popular with a lot of people. They've wanted us to see us do that, so that would provide the opportunity for that. So what we would be presenting as far as zones for waterfowl, we would present a north zone, which would be those white counties, and those season dates would stay similar to what they are now, and then the southern part of the state would be those green counties. And this is the same boundary that we had about 10 years ago. It seemed to work quite well for most people in the state, so that's what we'd be proposing again. The season dates would be associated with those. For our north zone would be the same as always. It would start on the first Saturday of October, so next year that would be October 7th. For the southern part of the state, that would be October 14th, so we'd only be able to start it a week later. For the scop dates, we'd start that on the general opener in the north part of the state, and that can only run for 86 days, so we'd run that for 86 days in the north part. In the southern part, we wouldn't start it until November and run it till the very end of the season for those 86 days. For bag limits for ducks, the only thing that would change is the pintail bag would go down to 1, but everything would stay the same as it was last year. And coot, snipe, and falconry bags would also stay the same as they have been in years past. For dark geese, we would be adjusting our zones a little bit. We'd have our eastern box elder Acania zone would be the same as last year with the same season dates. And the Wasatch front zone would also have the same season dates that it has had in the past. And we would modify that northern zone to be just those white counties in the north part of the state. And then the southern zone would be the black counties, and so that also corresponds with our duck zone. So we'd also be able to do away with the split for geese in the southern part of the state and just have a continuous season for all those species. For light geese, we do the same thing we have done in years past, split that season into two different grouping of dates, which is when we have the majority of our light geese in the state. And we have a few that move through in the fall, but primarily it's a spring hunt, so we'd put the majority of days in the spring to accommodate hunters when most of the light geese are here in the state. And the other only closed area during those hunt period would be Millard County, and that would be from February 5th to February 28th, and that would be to accommodate the light goose festival they have each year in Delta. Our tundra swan season dates would be the same as they usually are. It would end the second Saturday and or Sunday in December. Be for the Great Salt Lake hunt area, and 2,000 permits would be offered again for that hunt. And our youth day, it'd be for 17 or younger on July 31st of next year. For the northern dates, would be September 23rd, and the southern would be September 30th. And that would be for anybody under 18 years old, and anyone older than 15 would need a duck stamp, though, for that hunt. One rule change we are looking to do is adding a rest area to Ogden Bay. The majority of our waterfowl areas already have rest areas, and the benefit of this is it provides an area where birds can go and loaf during the day and then move out to feed off and on throughout the day. And so generally it provides more an opportunity to have more birds in the area as well as more bird movements, and overall usually makes hunting a lot better for hunters on our WMAs. This rest area would be directly west of the Ogden Bay headquarters. It's a couple hundred acres in size, and currently it's just a giant stand of Phragmites, so we'd be reducing all the Phragmites in that area, making a large pond there, and would essentially be located about right in the middle of Ogden Bay, and so we'd be strategic for hunters to be able to have access to birds all around it. Other changes we're making in rural, we are looking at modifying the definition for where we can hunt around the Farmington Bay Learning Center. That's a new building we'll be building out there coming this spring. And currently we have the rule written that you have to be 600 feet from that building. You can't discharge a firearm. So we'd be looking at just defining a whole boundary for the rest area and calling that or the Learning Center and calling that the Learning Center, and no shooting would be allowed within that area. We're also making a few changes to our SWAN application rule. We currently don't allow youth to apply as a group, so we'd be looking to make that change. We also have been holding back about 1% of our SWAN permits in case we did have an error, because we can't exceed 2,000 permits for that hunt. This was implemented prior to us having a preference point system, and we do have a point system in place now, so there's really no need to have that 1%. So we're looking to just do away with that in our rule. We also just need to redefine youth in this rule. We currently have it still listed as 15 or younger, and we need to adjust that to what we currently have in all of our other waterfowl rules as being 17 or younger. And that would apply for our swan drawing and our crane drawing. And those are all the recommendations I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Hi, Dan. Good to have you here.
Sorry.
Okay. RAC members, any questions on the presentation? Go ahead, Matt.
So, Blair, what will it take to get the pintail limit back up to 2? I mean, what kind of data will you be looking for? Or what I know that's probably the biggest concern of waterfowl hunters on this whole proposal is. Yeah. So, and a lot of times once you reduce numbers, it's really, really hard to get them back up. So I just question for you on that.
Yeah, so what's happening with the pintails is we have a harvest strategy that was developed by us, the states, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, which lists specific population levels as to what we'll have for a two-bird bag, a one-bird bag, and a close season. And so those are pretty much set in stone right now. They're based off of a lot of long-term data trends, as well as the spring survey that we do each year. And so for that to come back up to 2, all that would have to happen is the pintail population would have to come back up so we're above that threshold again. It's likely that'll probably happen in future years just because pintail populations tend to move quite a bit based on breeding conditions on the prairie pile regions. And so if an area is really dry, they'll tend to go north where they have better nesting conditions. So that is likely what probably happened with this last survey, but it is all dependent upon what the results are from that survey. So,
any other questions?
There we go. You made a comment about youth application, group applications for the youth on the SWAN. Can you give a little background on that? Do we allow group applications for everybody else, and this is just allowing them for youth specifically as groups? Or give me a little more detail there.
Yeah, so for some reason we didn't allow youth to apply as a group for any of our drawings about 10 years ago or so. We've changed that with deer and allowed youth to start applying for a group and several other species. So this is just a way for us to make all of our drawings consistent, as well as just allow youth to apply as a group for all of our drawings. So this is just trying to moving all those species through the process of doing that.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
The duck opener is very popular. With having two openers, are we going to have all the duck hunters that we used to spread out in the state north and then all of them south, or what's your guess with two openings?
That's a good question. I think it probably just depends on where the birds are at. I would imagine most people probably stay for that northern opener. I won't imagine we'll have as many people going south for the opener, but I guess it's anyone's guess right now until we actually try it. So.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll any questions from the audience? Okay, I don't have any cards for comments on this presentation. I have a comment card from Mr. Bigler, would you like to come forward, or can I just read that?
I'm DJ Bigler, representing the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. We agree and are fully behind the recommendations of the department on this agenda item.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else would like to make a comment? Okay. Seeing none, bring it back to the board. Any comments, questions, additional questions? Dan, grab a mic.
Yeah, no question. I'd just like to make the motion that we pass, as an avid duck hunter and whatnot, I think we ought to just pass this, make a motion that we pass all the recommendations by the division.
Okay, I have a motion. Second by Matt. Okay, we'll bring it to a vote. All in favor? Okay, the vote's unanimous. Okay. Thank you, Blair. Okay. We'll go on to agenda item number 6, 2017 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments. Rusty Robinson, make that presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rusty Robinson. I'm the statewide bighorn sheep and mountain goat biologist, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but we're currently going through a personnel change in our mammals coordinator position, so in the interim I've been asked to help out with the bear recommendation process, so here I am. I'll do my best to answer questions, but please forgive me if I defer to our regional personnel on some of this stuff. The current status of black bears in the state, our statewide population is currently growing at what we calculate is 4% annually with a gradual slowing trend. And our population modeling, this data is based on harvest and denning data. Here's a look at statewide success rates over the last 3 years. 2014, we're at 50%, 2015, 47%, and this year we're currently at 40, but we're still compiling data from some of our late fall hunts, so that number is going to go up a little bit. And there's a look at the overall total sport harvest over the last 3 years. Over the last 25 years, we've gradually increased permits, and we've total harvest has also increased right alongside it. The number of depredation and nuisance mortalities tends to hover right around 50 individuals a year. We've got some peaks and valleys, but this year we're currently at 48. Our black bear management plan is a 12-year plan, and we basically how the management strategy works is each unit is categorized into one of three harvest strategies, either light, moderate, or liberal, and you can see the percentage of our units that fall into each one of those categories, and then the performance targets are in yellow there, the percent adult males over 5 years old and percent females in the harvest. Those are the two performance targets that we look at when we recommend permit adjustments. And so based on what harvest strategy the unit falls in and where we're at in relation to that performance target, we can either remain stable or adjust up to 20%, or in the case where we're exceeding performance target, both performance targets in the same direction, we can adjust 20 to 40%, either up or down. And if we decide to move a unit into a different harvest strategy, then we can adjust permits up to 50% up or down. We currently offer several different types of hunts in the state. We offer a spring limited entry hunt, which is hounds only, no bait. We offer a summer limited entry hunt, which is bait or spot and stock, no hounds, with a 2-week preseason baiting period. And you can see the dates that correspond to those. We offer a fall limited entry hunt with a 2-week preseason baiting period. On the LaSalle and San Juan units, There's an exception where we have a no dog period from September 16th through September 25th. And on the Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek South, and Little Creek roadless areas, we have a fall limited entry archery only hunt where there's no dogs allowed, but bait is allowed. We also offer spot and stock limited entry hunts that are no hounds, no bait. And those are on the Book Cliffs, LaSalle, and San Juan units. There is a correction needs to be made on your hunt tables there by the door. On the Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek South, multi-season hunt, it lists all three or four hunt dates there. The last one should be October 2nd through November 16th instead of October 3rd. So forgive me for that error. We also offer multi-season limited entry hunts where permit holder may hunt any open dates that are specific to the unit with a two-week preseason baiting period. And we also offer harvest objective hunts where unlimited permits are sold and the unit closes when the quota is met. And we have those currently in the spring and the fall. Moving on to regional recommendations. On the northeastern region, we're recommending no change from last year. Likewise, in the northern region, we're recommending no change. In the central region, we're recommending an increase of 5 permits on the Central Mountains Nebo unit. This is a unit that historically, for the last 5 years, we've been at 21 permits. We feel like the bear density is going up. We're getting more bears running around Spanish Fork, and felt like it was time to do a slight increase there. In the southeastern region is where we have the bulk of our recommended changes. We're recommending a 10-permit increase on the Central Mountains Manti South San Rafael North unit, and that's largely to deal with livestock-related depredation issues where we feel like we can hopefully shift some of that harvest to hunters instead of depredation or nuisance mortalities. On the LaSalle's and the San Juan, we're recommending a 15-permit increase on both of those units. We're exceeding performance targets in both categories. And the same with 9 Mile, exceeding performance targets in both categories. And we're recommending it's a 2-permit increase, but a 2-quota increase, if that makes sense. So the spring quota hunt, we're recommending be changed from 18 to 20, and then the summer limited entry is where those other 2 permits would come into play, from 6 to 8. We're also recommending a boundary change in the southeastern region. This is just a bit of housekeeping so that our shapes are more consistent across species. So this would just affect that northern tip of the San Juan unit by Moab. Probably wouldn't affect bear harvest at all. And again, just so we're consistent with other species. And because the LaSalle unit borders that, we would have to change that unit as well. So we're recommending that minor change in that unit. In the southern region, we're recommending a 2-permit decrease on the beaver unit. So we're kind of shifting things around. We're actually recommending a kind of a new hunt, but it's just recommending the multi-season aspect of the beaver hunt. So 2 permits on the multi-season part of it. We're recommending a 1-permit increase on the Dutton, a 1-permit increase on Panguitch Lake Zion, and a 1-permit decrease on the Ponsagon. I know these seem like token increases or decreases, but when you have a unit that recommends 6 permits, it's and the plan calls for 20%, that's kind of what it is. So general pursuit season, we're recommending the spring dates of April 1st to June 2nd, summer dates from July 5th to August 6th, and fall from October 28th to November 16th. For our restricted pursuit season, we're recommending no change in permits, with an early season date of July 5th through July 19th and a late summer date from July 25th to August 6th. So in summary, we're recommending a total of 759 bear permits statewide, which is an increase of 46 permits from last year. The breakdown is plus 16 on spring limited entry, 14 on summer, 11 on fall, and 5 on multi-season hunts. and we're recommending an increase of 2 on the harvest objective quota on the 9 mile, and boundary changes on the San Juan and LaSalle bear units, and a new hunt for the beaver multi-season. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Rusty. Any questions from the rack on that? Chris?
Hey, Rusty. Just a quick question. We're looking at these tag numbers, both increases staying the same, decreases. I didn't see any. We talked a little bit about the metrics and that are in the management plan as far as harvest strategies. I didn't see anything that showed what our sow harvest was, that sort of thing, to be able to compare that against the metrics and what the, right, the tag increases were.
If you got a specific unit in mind, we can look it up.
Well. Yeah, I mean, there would certainly be some in the central region we'd want to take a look at. It would be good, though, I think, to be able to take a look at all of them prior to the meeting and go through those. Yeah, but if you've got those, that'd be great.
Yeah, what unit specifically? Riley can probably pull those up.
Sorry about that. For the Wasatch, last year it's about 44%, but like we said, some of the fall numbers are still coming back. That is a liberal unit, 40 to 45%, so it's a liberal strategy, so we fall right in to where we want to be there. And then for the Nebo, it is 38%, which with a liberal strategy as well, we're right where we want to be there, but we did recommend fly permit increase on the Nebo since we are a little lower on some of the factors.
Chris, did you want to know more about the male female?
So that,
yeah,
that was just
the sow harvest that and
was the
age.
Sow.
Yeah.
And so the age. You want age, average age as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know that we have the average age for. For 16, right here.
So it's got a percent adult male and an average age.
So average age for the Nebo was 4.5 this year, and then it was. 5 on the Wasatch. So on the Wasatch, since it is a liberal unit, it's right at both of those triggers, at percent at 5-year-old and also the percent harvest of sows.
But the Nebo's off on both of those, right? Out of the range?
So, right, the Nebo does have the ability to increase on both of those and is not within the, okay, the triggers.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Dan?
Yeah, Rusty. So I assume that some of the issues are related to this prolonged drought. Could you just talk a little bit about that? Am I right? I mean,
I'm not a bear biologist, but I studied polar bears, but they're a little different. Droughts don't affect them too much. But, I don't know what to say other than bears are obviously very affected by weather conditions and food availability, and harvest largely, I think, echoes what's going on. As far as from a bear biologist perspective, I don't have a better answer for you. Unless one of you guys wants to tackle that. But I think you're right. I think bear harvest is largely dependent on weather and Friday night snowstorms. This probably affects it quite a bit too.
Any other questions? Ben?
Rusty, you're probably not going to have this information, but something to think about, and whether it's you bring this back to us next year or somebody else to pass it on, if it's not you. But this will be our third year with this new hunt structure, with the summer season, and with allowing the ability to hunt with a rifle over bait and all these changes. It'd be really interesting, I think, to see how the application distribution has been since we've made those changes, because we've introduced a lot of new stuff. It'd be interesting to see where those applicants are applying, you know, for which hunts. Are we seeing the majority, you know, running hounds, baiting? What are we doing?
Yeah.
I'm guessing you probably don't have that information tonight.
No, not off the top of my head. We can take a look at that for you.
Sure.
And talk afterwards, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions? I have a question. Okay. On the spring bear hunt, it ends June 2nd. The summer bear hunt starts June 3rd. The summer bear hunters can bait 2 weeks prior, so they're overlapping into the spring bear hunt season. Can a spring bear hunter shoot a bear over bait?
They're not supposed to. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The reason why I asked that is because I was involved in an exact situation. We'd put some cameras out. We knew there were bears in this particular area. We sit there, and we saw that they'd coming in. We were sitting there. We had people come in, set up baits in front of our camera, right where we sat. What are we supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? That's a law enforcement issue, maybe.
Yeah.
But the spring bear hunter didn't put that bait there. And it caused some angst among some hunters, to tell you the truth.
Jason, you need to get your law enforcement guys. No, I think that's a good comment to make, and I appreciate that concern. Can you speak to that?
The question is it legal for the spring bear hunter to kill a bear that's on a bait that he didn't put out?
No, but if you got somebody who's moving into your area and has a question, contact us. You've got a summer hunter who brought them in, and we can contact them because they're supposed to have their baits issued.
Yeah, we did that. We got a hold of Jay, and we told him the situation, and he wasn't sure what you should do. Yeah, and it'll happen more often now. With that 2 weeks, you know, I mean, there's bears in the area, and if a spring bear hunter's out there trying to find a bear, and somebody puts bait out there where he's hunting, what are you supposed to do? Say, okay, I guess we don't hunt no more. Yeah, that's a spring bear hunt. It's spot and stalks, no bait, no hounds. Then the summer tag holder, he came in 2 weeks ahead of his hunt, puts the bait right in the area where we're hunting. It creates problem, you know. See, the spring bear hunters, they were mad because we were in the area and it was their bait, and yet they took our camera. And anyway, we'll deal with that. But anyway, that could be a problem. I mean, who's it wrong? Who's right? Who's wrong? I mean, it's kind of ripe for a lot of problems. I mean, if you got two guys that one drew out for summer and one for spring, and the summer guy comes in and says, hey, I'll put some bait out there. It's not your bait. Go ahead and hunt there. Okay. So anyway.
Aside from that, have you seen an increase in, you know, with the two-week preseason baiting, have we had many issues?
I think it just needs to be clarified, especially for the spring bear hunter, so that he doesn't feel like that he could get in trouble because he ends up shooting a bear that's coming into a bait station.
It's a good comment.
Yeah, we don't want that conflict.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, any questions from the public on this presentation?
Dan Cockane, Utah Houndsman. Do you have the numbers on the conflicts and the depredation bears that were taken in this region?
Do you have those broken down by region, Riley?
Yeah, for both Eagle and Wasatch.
Yeah.
On for conflict bears on the Nebo, there were 5 taken this year, and then there were 8 on the Wasatch.
So the Wasatch is way down?
Yeah, quite a bit down.
Another question. Come on forward.
Chet Young. This question is kind of for you too, Riley. On the depredating bears, the rule used to be with Wildlife Services that it had to be a fresh kill within 24 hours. And that has since changed where they can go in front of like a sheep herd in a problem area and take a bear out before it's a nuisance bear, a depredating bear. Is there a way that we can put that on records to where that bear's not a depredating bear, you know, because it shows it as a depredation bear, but really the bear's not depredating just for the future on this, you know, going forward?
I guess that is something maybe we could talk to Wildlife Services and work through. I mean, that's the purpose for the Wasatch being the liberal unit that it is in hopes of getting the hunters out to kill those bears before they cause a problem or Wildlife Services has to come and take them. And so the goal is to give the bear harvest to the sportsmen and not to Wildlife Services. So I guess that's a tough question to answer, but it is something I would be willing to bring up with Wildlife Services and see what options we have and where we could work forward with them. I think you're talking specifically on the Wasatch unit.
I am.
Yeah, and so, you know, they work with us well. We have a good communication. It'd be something I'd be willing to bring up and discuss and see what opportunities we have. And if they know of a bear, let us know before they get it, and maybe we can get a sportsman on. But I'm willing to go and make those conversations, but I don't, as far as a rule change or policy change, that's a tough question to answer at the moment.
Right. It's just more of a documentation thing because there was 8 nuisance bears took for depredation.
Right.
But if 4 of them were killed in front of the sheep,
right,
then, you know, that would bring that number way down as far as a depredating bear, which kind of changes numbers.
Right.
You know, and the reason for the harvest objective.
Right.
Number 2, is there a chance we're going to get away from this harvest objective on the Wasatch in the next go-around?
You know, we will reevaluate that completely when on the next go-around, the next time that plan comes up. That's not something that is permanent. That's something that Dale does a fantastic job in evaluating and looking at that and giving us the options. Harvest objective came about on the Wasatch because of the number of bears being taken by depredation and the amount that we needed to trap and move or division removals, which, like I said earlier, have been way down. We're at 8. We've been as high as 20 in the last 5 years. And so we hope that the plan is working. But it is something that we will always reevaluate and look at further, sure.
Right. And the last question is, I was part of the bear management plan when that was structured. And we did that with Kevin Bunnell and, you know, the University of Utah. There were a bunch of people involved. And at the time, Kevin promised us that units like the Wasatch would never fit in the criteria of being a harvest objective. It was structured for places like the 9 Mile with lots of private land and access issues. So have we looked into how the Wasatch fits that criteria now, considering everybody that voted on that was told that units like the Wasatch would never be a part of the harvest objective?
Yeah, I don't know that I was definitely not part of the plan, so I don't know what was promised and what wasn't. I can say that I feel like the Wasatch, for the purposes that we are trying to accomplish, like I've told you, fits a harvest objective well. Will it always fit that way? Is that always going to be the plan? I can't say that. But at the moment, I personally think that it was a good move, and we are putting more tags into the hands of the sportsmen and not into Wildlife Services killing bears. We're seeing that number drop. If that continues to be the case, I think it is a successful plan. We'd all rather see a hunter harvest a bear than have it be shot off of a dead sheep. So
right.
There are reasons for it. I think it fits well. I don't know what was said or promised before I got here, so I apologize. I can't speak to that, but I do believe it's the right plan. Currently, will it be the next go around? I don't know, but we are always willing to sit down with you and hear all the sportsmen's concerns and what we have going forward and see what needs to be improved upon, if anything.
Okay. One more question for Ben. Would you be against, on the next go around, putting the, instead of having the summer bait season, having it back in the spring? Or do you think there would be too many conflicts?
Are you asking to swap the spring and the summer? Or
no,
I'm asking
to combine it the way it was.
Oh, to combine it, okay.
With hound and bait. I know Richard had a problem with that, but I would like your opinion.
Yeah, and concerning Richard's problem, I think that's really an edge case. I mean, this is the first time I've heard of that. I can see the potential for it happening, but I really think that's an edge case. Riley, I have a follow-up question for you. We're talking about on the next go-around. I want to figure out what that is, because the bear plan is a 12-year plan, but it was designed to be implemented in 3-year cycles. So when we're talking next go-around, are we talking next year, or are we talking in 9 years? What are we talking here?
Next year. Okay. I mean, we can reevaluate the hunt strategy. The 12-year plan is putting it into a liberal season and kind of the sideboards of that, and that will not be reevaluated on a yearly basis, but we do have the opportunity to adjust the hunt strategy on a yearly basis.
Yeah, so next year we're coming into a new 3-year
right.
cycle.
And honestly, it was looked at this year and evaluated mm-hmm. this year and thought over, and we sure. agreed that we still believe that this is the right strategy for the unit.
Yeah, and so I imagine next year we're probably going to have possibly some fairly significant discussions regarding whether or not to continue the hunt structures as we have today, which is kind of what you're alluding to, right? And determine, for example, do we keep the summer season? Do we keep harvest objective here on the Wasatch? I imagine those are going to be some pretty heavy discussions next year.
Right. They will be discussed. They'll be evaluated. Absolutely.
I mean, so, Chet, to answer your question, kind of being put on spot, haven't really considered that a whole lot, and that's a big decision that I'd want to discuss with my membership and my board. I mean, I could support it either way. Personally, I have, and I've hunted both the last 2 years on the summer season with friends that have drawn tags, and I think it's been a great hunt. I think we should keep it there. I think it's been going well. So, specific to like the, I don't know, this new plan's got a lot of strategies and I think the division's using them well to accomplish the goals. We've seen specifically here on the Wasatch where this, I know you don't like the harvest objective on the Wasatch, but it's doing what it's designed to do, right? We're reducing those conflicts, and I think we've been successful at it. So I think that's a big discussion to have next year. I don't know that I can give you a straight answer right now, but if I was put on the spot, I'd probably say I'd like to see that summer season stay.
Right. So. Well, I worked with you before. I just wanted your opinion.
Yeah, sure. And I appreciate that. And definitely continue to work together in the future.
Okay.
Sorry, most of my questions were just answered there, but I'm Brad Oskelthorpe. I'm here on behalf of the Utah Wool Growers and Red Pine Ranches. We have some permits in the strawberry area. We have a lot of problems with bears up there. So anything we can support increase of bear permits would be great. Like I said, we killed roughly this past summer, about 15 bears up in that area. So anything we can do to get more bears down would be great. Sheep, I mean, the bears love the sheep for some reason. Don't know why, but they love the sheep. So we would support anything that can be put out there to get more permits. Thank you.
Thank you. Remember this, okay, is there any more questions? Any more questions?
My name is Jason Binder. I have a couple of questions. What is our state bear population?
That data just doesn't exist. To know the exact number of bears is just really difficult. The thing we use instead is we model populations based on age and harvest data, and then we go back in time to determine demographics and get a minimum number, but it's relative to itself. So we know if we're increasing or decreasing, but not a total population number.
Doesn't it make it kind of hard to determine a population when we keep increasing tags every year so the harvest is always different?
I think it's a great question. I think you're asking if we're trying to hit a moving target. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, so to me it's kind of hard to determine a bear population using numbers if every year we keep increasing tags. Last year we increased tags, the year before, and now we're looking at another 46. So obviously more bears are being killed, more bears are being turned in. But how do we know we're not damaging the population?
Well, we do that with all our species, with deer, with elk, with everything. We use those numbers to calculate what our harvest is going to be. And it is a moving target, but we can do that. I guess what you're asking is, what's the alternative? Would you to stay the same for a year or something?
Yeah, to keep keep the tags the same for like three consecutive years so you can see if there's ups and downs.
I don't know if we can, if that's a recommendation, this is a public process. You're willing to make that recommendation.
All right. Another question. Do we have numbers on sow harvest and the harvest objective on Wasatch?
Hey, Riley, I think you gave me 44% for sow harvest.
That was the percentage overall, but not necessarily.
Yeah, that was
why. That's what I was looking for, was the sow harvest.
We think we're 50%, 6 and 6.
So there was 12 bears killed on the harvest objective? Out of 25? The last I looked, there was 17 bears killed on the harvest objective when the hunt was still open. That's why I'm here.
So there's a
shuttle has a hard subjective.
Okay.
What about those harvest tables? It might be on there.
Another question is, I had heard through the grapevine it was 12,017 out of 17. So, my next question is, how many violations are written for wet sows?
Law enforcement, can you speak to that?
Okay, because the biggest problem I have with this being close to 50% is if we're killing half of our bears, almost half of our bears are sows, then there's obviously some wet sows dying. Then obviously somebody's breaking the law and nobody's being written a ticket for it, correct?
I don't know. We have to look up those numbers and see what violations have been written.
Okay. To me, if no violations are being written, then that's basically poaching, correct? Because it's against the law to chase a sow with cubs or to kill a sow with cubs, correct?
That would be a violation as far as I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Question or comment?
Question.
Okay. Come on.
Chet Young, one last question. On there it shows that there was 8 bears killed for depredation.
Yeah.
We just heard that there was 15 killed on the Wasatch.
That was our question as well. We've got to maybe get
by
together
Brad,
afterwards.
What's somewhere information's not getting back to you guys, or what? What's the process now to see where we're at? Because we obviously we're looking at this saying this harvest objective is working. If our numbers are off 50%.
Brad, do you have anything to clarify? That was 15 this summer. So it may be a difference of just the unit split. Let's get together afterwards, Brad, and make sure our numbers jive.
Just a sec. Let's get some comments and we'll come back and do a question. I have some comments cards here. I think all of you have been up and asked questions. Do any of you want to make a comment on the presentation at this point in the public?
DJ Bigler representing Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. There's been a lot of questions asked here this evening that we're not getting answers to, but SFW feels that we should support the department with their wildlife biologists, and SFW recommends that we agree with the division on their recommendations and support their findings for this bear hunt for next year.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Comments?
Dan Cockayne, Utah Houndsman. We sent a letter to most of you that your emails worked, and we had a couple issues on in some other regions, but other than those, we support the division's recommendations.
Okay.
We are a little alarmed at this Wildlife Services revelation, if that's...
Sounds like they need to find out which unit they were actually taken in. Just close it up. Okay. All right, thanks, Dan. Any other comments? Okay, bring it back to the board. Chris has a follow-up that he'd like to discuss.
So, Riley, Rusty, just a quick question. I wonder if we could bring up the slide with the performance metrics.
Sure.
Yeah, that one right there. So what I was asking for both the Wasatch and the Nebo is what was the performance for 2016 against those metrics there?
What were our numbers on both of those?
Yes.
Units? So it's both of those are liberal units, correct, Riley, which calls for the performance targets of male, adult male over 5 years old, under 25%. And we were... What number there, Riley? ~20% And then female between 40 and 45, we were at 44, correct?
Okay, so that was the sow number then, not the success rate. Was just the harvest subjective?
The amount of sows taken only on the harvest.
Right, okay. Right. But overall sow, 44%.
So we were within both of those performance targets on that unit.
Okay, but on the Nebo, the sow harvest was 48%.
I believe it's 38, is that correct? 38 on the female harvest.
Okay.
And what were males on that, Riley? You're going to have that table memorized by the end of this. Percent. Adult males.
No. So what the target says?
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. We were within target on the male and out of target on the female, which allows for an adjustment of up to 20%.
Okay, because my confusion has been just understanding what the performance, what we actually did against the metrics, and that's what I've really struggled with in this particular discussion. To understand, I think the biologists do a great job and the division works hard, but I think making sure that, one of the biggest complaints that I get from the folks that I represent is, why do we make management plans if we're not going to follow them? So I think it's really important, if we're going to make recommendations and approve recommendations and those sorts of things, that it's making sure it's staying true to the management plan. And I think the human conflict, is an important issue, but I don't think we should lose sight of the metrics that we have in the plan to address those conflicts. I think that's very important. And if we need to, we talked about, addressing the plan again next year, and perhaps we should think about this a little bit more, because the bear harvest due to human conflicts has to have a boundary. We can't reduce our bear populations down below a sustainable level just because there's conflicts reported. At some point the Wasatch is going to not have any bears on it if we keep going too far, I think. But anyway, I just I just wanted to check these metrics and what our performance was against that. So at the end of the day, we are you're proposing no increase to the Wasatch, right?
Correct. And that's what I want to clarify is according to the plan, it would be a no permit increase. But it sounds like maybe your concerns are with the baseline number that we're already using from last year.
Perhaps, okay. Yeah. Certainly. But it sounds like we're within the metrics. But I wanted to just confirm. So no permit increases for the Wasatch.
Correct.
And what was the increase for the Nebo, too?
Five permit on Five the Nebo, yeah.
Five permits. Okay.
Okay. And I believe it's three. I was going to ask George, see what kind of conflicts he's aware of.
Just, you know, as a Forest Service rep and probably the one agency that owns most of the land on the Nebo, I don't have an issue with the increase in five, and mainly because our numbers show that folks are visiting Nebo at an increased rate. It's increasing every year, the visitation up there. And I think the human conflicts with bears are going to continue to increase. You look at the Wasatch Front here, all the multi-unit level buildings that are going up, they're going to house more and more people. And our guard station is an indication of that. We opened the guard station up as a public rental a year and a half ago. That thing's been booked every single day of the summer. There's a waiting list for next year already. So you're just going to get more and more people on the Nebo, and you're going to continue to have bear conflicts up there.
Yeah, and I think that's understandable. But if we're going to continue to have wild places and wild things, you know, we've got to keep a sustainable population as well, maintain a plan, and adhere to that plan.
I can tell you from personal experience, the Nebo's bear population is pretty healthy, guaranteed, because I'll see more bear than I will deer when I go up there.
Yeah, and I'm
it's
good.
It's not unusual to see a bear every time you go. It's just not.
Yeah, and I'm good with that if we're within the performance metrics. I just didn't know if we were. That was
a good comment. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments from the RAC members? Dan?
Oh, sorry, Dan. Yeah, although I kill ducks, I don't hunt bear, but I really appreciate the division. Sorry. I really appreciate the opportunities provided. There's a really diverse opportunity for baiting and hounds and stalking and all that. So I just think that it's a really healthy overall approach to dealing with these critters.
Thank you. Ben?
I'd like to bring up a concern that I have. I don't know if I'd even call it a concern. I've talked to Rusty about this. Earlier this year, I was on a hunt during the summer season with some friends with a 12-year-old who was lucky enough to draw a tag. We had a great hunt. We set him up in a blind. He killed a bear. And we realized, as we got talking through this hunt, that mentored hunting is not allowed for bears. And I personally think it would be a great opportunity for mentored hunting. And I've talked to Rusty and I've talked to Lindy about this, and maybe, John, if you could provide some wildlife board input on what it would take to change that. From what I understand, it's got to go to the legislature first. It's for
change implemented
for the wildlife force position. Okay. So, John, I would ask you if there's anything to make that, to get that ball rolling, is there anything you would need from our RAC to help further that along? Because that's something I'd love to see.
Well, I mean, you can make any motion you want. If that's something you want to see looked into, make a motion and pass it, and that way it's on the minutes and we can put it in the action log and at least discuss it. It's a lot more likely to get talked about if there's a motion made that the chairman can bring up to the wildlife board than if it's just something like we're doing right now in the minutes. So if that's something you want to see looked at or asked about, make a motion and then your chairman will report on that and we'll have a good opportunity to discuss that and get some good answers and put it on the record.
Okay. Thanks, John. With that, Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate, I'd like to make that motion at this time.
Go ahead. So let me be clear on the motion. You'd like the mentoring program to apply to bear or all?
Well, I'm bringing it up specific to bear.
Okay.
But,
to apply the mentoring program to
the youth
all
mentoring
bear
program.
hunting in Utah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, for that to be an option. Yeah.
Okay. Ken will second it. Okay, we'll call for a vote on that. All in favor of that motion, raise your hand. Vote unanimous. Okay. We'll report that to the board. Okay, any other comments, any motions you'd like to make at this point? I'll entertain a motion to accept that.
I'll make the motion that we accept the bear changes and regulations as presented by the division.
Okay, Carl, we have a motion. I'll second. Ken seconds that motion. All in favor? Okay, that passes unanimous. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, private pond rule amendments. Randy Hoplinger, Cold Water Sports Fishery.
That's not it. That's the wrong one.
Okay, well, thank you for the introduction, Mr. Chair. Like you said, my name is Randy Hoplinger, and I'm the Cold Water Sport Fish Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife Resources. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about some proposed rule changes that we would like to make. Actually, two rules, our aquaculture and fish stocking rule and our private fish pond rule. And really, before I get into the nuts and bolts of the rule change that we're proposing today, I actually just want to provide just a little bit of background to kind of set up why we're proposing this rule change. This rule change that we're proposing really affects Utah's private aquaculture industry. So when we talk about the private aquaculture industry, we're talking about privately owned businesses within the state that produce fish that are stocked within privately held waters in the state, so on private property. This is an important industry for us here in the state, and they're an important partner for the Division of Wildlife. The reason why we feel that they're really an important partner is because one of the primary missions of the division is to help recruit anglers and more people draw more interest in the fishing in the state. And a lot of people first experience fishing by fishing in just little ponds that are on private property. But anyway, we've been working with the industry since about 2008, having regular meetings with the industry to help the industry out and help understand some of the concerns that the industry has. So earlier this year, we were had a meeting with the industry, and they came with some concerns that they had for us. And what these concerns really boiled down to is that they feel like there's a lot of waters in the state that they currently can't stock fish into. And because they can't stock fish into these waters, it's really hampering the industry and limiting their opportunities to expand and sell fish. So really, the specific concerns they had is, first off, under our current rules, we state that fish cannot be stocked on the privately owned ponds that are situated on natural stream channels. A second issue that they had is that fish cannot be stocked in the privately owned ponds that lack screens in the inlet and outlet structures. And what they feel like is there's a lot of ponds in the state that are on natural stream channels and that lack screens on the inlet and outlet structures they could potentially be stocking fish into that they can't stock fish into at this time. Another concern the industry had is they felt that our current rule didn't clearly spell out sterility and species requirements for particular locations within the state. The current rules that we have in the state are really intended to help prevent fish that are stocked on privately owned land from escaping that private property and interacting with wild fish. That's really done to kind of protect native fish in the state, but what we really acknowledge is there actually are situations where stocking fish in natural stream channels or ponds that don't have screens on the inlet and outlet structures actually poses very little threat to native fish. So given that, that kind of leads into the rule changes that we're proposing today. So what we're proposing to do is eliminate Administrative Rule R657-16, which is the aquaculture and fish stocking rule. And we'd like to combine the core elements of that with Rule R657-59, which is our private fish pond rule. So the proposed title for the new rule is going to be Private Fish Ponds, Short-Term Fishing Events, Private Fish Stocking, and Institutional Aquaculture. And what we realized looking at these two rules is both these rules have an effect on the private aquaculture industry. And we realized looking at these rules that there was a lot of overlap of language and some inconsistencies in the regulations that the industry experienced. And by combining these two rules, what we're able to do is improve the regulatory consistency, remove that overlap of language, and provide the industry with just a single rule they have to follow that's relatively streamlined and simpler than the current rules the industry experiences. As part of combining these rules, some other stuff that we did is we eliminated all parts that were not essential to native fish conservation purposes. And we also removed language that duplicates a corresponding rule in the Department of Agriculture that also has an effect on private aquaculture industry. And what we're left with, again, is a single rule that presents the private aquaculture industry here in Utah really a similar set of requirements that the industry faces in other states here in the western part of the United States. So this schematic here kind of shows what the old rule looks like and also show how the new rule kind of acts and helps benefit the private aquaculture industry. So when we look at private ponds in the state, we're really looking at three criteria. So we're looking at whether or not the ponds are situated on natural stream channels. We're looking at whether or not the ponds have screens on both the inlet and outlet structures. And we're also looking for whether the fish species that the pond owner desires is permitted for stocking in the area. Now, under the current rule, what we're looking at is we're looking for ponds that are not located on natural stream channels. We're looking for ponds that have screens on both the inlet and outlet structures. And we're looking for that the fish species that the pond owner desires is permitted for stocking in the given area. And if all three of those criteria are met, that means the pond owner does not need a certificate of registration, and they can approach a business that sells fish and purchase fish at any time. Now, this left pathway right here is the only pathway under the current rules that is available in the state. What we're proposing to do is basically add this right pathway here, where we're basically saying whether if there's a situation where one of those criteria isn't met, so the pond might be located on a natural stream channel, or the pond might not have screens on both the inlet and outlet structures, or the fish species is desired for stocking maybe isn't permitted for stocking in an area, what a pond owner can do is they can approach the Division of Wildlife. We'll evaluate that situation, and if we feel it's appropriate to stock fish, we'll grant a certificate of registration. And if that certificate of registration is granted, then they can approach the private aquaculture business and purchase fish. So what we feel like is this new rule really addresses the main concerns that the private aquaculture industry had. So, well, first off, one of the primary concerns that they had is they felt that they wanted to be able to stock fish within natural stream channels in the state. Under this revised rule, what we're basically saying is that if a pond owner approaches the Division of Wildlife and receives a certificate of registration, there are opportunities to stock fish on natural stream channels. The industry also asked us to remove pond screening requirements. Again, we're under the current or the proposed rule, what we're saying is that pond owners can approach the division and receive a certificate of registration if their pond is evaluated and there are situations where we could stock fish or the industry could stock fish in the ponds that lack screens on inlet and outlet structures. Another request of the industry is they wanted to be able to stock disease-certified sterile salmonids into any screened, off-channel, privately owned pond in the state. The rule they're proposing allows that to happen. The only exception is that brown trout and brown trout hybrids cannot be stocked in the Washington County. And the reason for that is there's actually some recovery agreements that prohibit the stocking of brown trout and brown trout hybrids in Washington County. And that affects both the industry and the Division of Wildlife. We don't think this affects the industry too much. Washington County's down there near St. George. It's just too warm for trout really to live. So there aren't really a lot of stocking opportunities down there in the first place. The industry also requested additional clarity on where their fish can be stocked. So they had concerns about just understanding what species and sterility of fish are permitted within particular waters within the state. The rule that we're proposing, we've clarified the language a little bit to help provide that clarity. And also to help the industry out, we've developed a web-based smartphone-compatible map that allows the industry to basically look at the map, look at a pond that they're considering for stocking, and basically determine the species and sterility requirements at that particular location. The industry also requested some simplification of the reporting requirements for the stocking of the fish. We used to require them to hold on to a lot of paperwork. The proposed rule, we're simplifying that a little bit. We're cutting down some of the reporting criteria. And also to help the industry out, we've actually developed a simple online reporting tool that basically allows them to enter the information on their fish stocking events. And also, we made that autofill, so that means that there's duplicate information they have to enter for every stocking event, like the company name, address, phone number, automatically fill. So it just reduces the amount of time that they have to spend reporting their information. Another thing is the industry, when they met with us, they told us that they preferred certificates of registration over exemptions in situations where people were considering stocking ponds maybe without screens on the inlet or outlet structure. They made that request to us because when there's a certificate of registration grant, there's a little bit more of a paper trail regarding whether or not the division actually authorized that stocking to occur. And they wanted to see that paper trail a little bit more just to make sure that the stocking events, if they were going to stock fish on a property, was in fact valid and approved by the Division of Wildlife. So what we did in the proposed rule is we only allow certificates of registration. The certificate of registration are actually going to last for 5 years instead of the current 1 year. And we think this is very beneficial to pond owners because it just reduces the frequency that they have to apply for a certificate of registration, just reduces some of the paperwork, some of the costs, and also provides some stability to the industry because the industry knows that if a pond owner receives a certificate of registration, they'll be able to stock that pond for at least 5 years. Now, one thing that the industry did request is that these exemptions that we turn in the certificates of registration last for the lifetime of the pond owner. We decided to go with the 5-year certificate of registration because it gives us the opportunity just to react to changes in the landscape and just scientific knowledge about a particular stocking location. Now, the last request that the industry made is they felt that it wasn't their responsibility to document the catch of fish from short-term fishing events. This is something under the current rule they thought was their responsibility. And we just clarified the rule that we're proposing tonight to basically say that that's not the industry's responsibility. So that's all I have, and I'd like to thank you for your time tonight.
Okay. Thanks, Randy. Okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
We have a little pond that's on some property up on Cold Mountain by Monroe Mountain. Do I need a core for that? Because that's not on a stream. Okay. It doesn't have any screens because it really doesn't have any outlets. Because it's spring-fed, snow melt, and then what's left is just enough that seeps up out of the ground. It's about 14 feet deep. Do I need a core for something like that?
Under the current rule, you technically do need a COR for that. This proposed rule addresses really the exact situation that you're discussing right there, where you could traditionally, under the current rule, you would never be allowed to put fish in that pond. But under the rule proposing, you could receive a certificate of registration.
Because I have out of core and I have bought fish and they've taken them and put them in there. You know, they don't winter over. They winter kill all of them. But how do you find out what species is appropriate or will be allowed in a certain area?
Are you asking how would a pond owner
Yeah.
know what's appropriate?
Yeah, how would they know what species they can?
Well, the rule does spell it out. The online reporting tool is going to have that information as well. And we're also arming that information with members of the private aquaculture sector. So you could, you know, contact a business or wherever you would like to purchase fish from, give them the location of your pond, and they could tell you what's allowed in an area.
Okay.
Or you could ask the division. We could tell you as well.
Any other questions?
Yes, Randy. In the past, we had whirling disease introduced into this state. With these changes in the rules, we got plans there that will pretty much block any disease coming in from the private aquaculture. I just worry about disease being brought in that maybe the state isn't, that we don't need here, like we had whirling disease brought in.
Yeah, and that actually goes to the Department of Agriculture end of things. They monitor, basically, if the private aquaculture sector is importing fish in the state, there's certain requirements for, you know, disease testing and that kind of thing. And individual private aquaculture facilities, if they're producing fish in state, say producing their own eggs, hatching them out, raising the fish, again, those fish have to be disease tested and certified by the Department of Agriculture before they're permitted for stocking. And whirling disease is one of the pathogens they're looking for in that testing.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll go to the audience, public. Any questions on the presentation? Okay, seeing none. Any comments? Robert Judd, come forward.
Thank you, Richard, for giving me the opportunity. First off, I want to introduce that I am president of the Utah Aquaculture Association. I am also one of the growers. There's three of us that are allowed currently to grow fish and deliver them live in the state. So I'm one of three that are there. But I want to thank Randy and the division for the time that they've spent with us in meetings, hashing over these rules and trying to come up with plans that we feel would be beneficial to the customer and also to the growers. And so overall, as we look at this rule, we agree with the majority of what this rule is. But like any rule, there are certain things that as an industry, we still struggle with. And some of that is some of the exact thing you just brought up. When a customer calls us, how can we describe to them whether they can or cannot have fish in a certain area? And currently in the rule, it states that if you're on a natural stream channel, you can't stock fish unless you meet all those requirements. We'd like to actually see, and we propose to this body that you guys maybe look at, that we actually eliminate that natural stream channel altogether, and you actually propose that in place of that, if a private pond or a private owner of land has a piece of land and the water is generated on that land, then he should be able to screen that and populate that body of water without a COR, and that should be pretty easy. Most of our facilities are like what you're describing, or it'd be a situation like just what you described. In order to try and protect the wildlife of the state of Utah or those wild fish, you know, if you had a piece of property and water flowed from another place into your property and out of your property, in a situation like that, you would need to, you know, you would need to take that water into an offshoot, into a pond, screen it, and then put that water back into the water. And that would then still allow you to have fish without a COR as long as those are met. But what the division is offering to be able to stock a stream or something like that without a COR altogether is or without screens altogether through a COR process is definitely an increase in something we haven't seen. But our proposal would be that you would look at, instead of stating that you can't stock a natural stream channel, the reason why is that fish can only be stocked where there is water. And if you define a natural stream channel, which is... we've gone round and round about trying to define it, but where water flows, that's where it's natural. And that's where fish are going to survive. You can't put fish out on dry land and expect them to live. And so that's why we propose that if you would maybe look at that or discuss it among yourselves and make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board, that would be awesome. But overall, I want to just tell you that the rule is much simpler than what it was. And overall, we agree with the rule. And we appreciate the work that we have been able to do with the aquatics people and the Division of Wildlife.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rack for any comments, further questions. Chris?
Yeah, I had a question. So if I understand your comments, it's Robert, right?
It is.
So if I understand your comments, you're asking us to consider recommending eliminating the need for a COR if water originates and terminates on somebody's land, private landowners.
Well, currently that would still be able to help. What we're talking about is that right now in the rule it states you cannot stock fish in a natural stream channel.
Right.
Well, basically wherever water flows, that's a natural
stream. Right, no, I understand that, but you're asking for an exception. If water originates and terminates within the boundaries of a private
That's what we were asking, land. Yep. And that if it's a flow-through situation where it flows from one place into another, you know, from some other place through their property and out, then they would need to divert that water and screen it and then be allowed to stock it.
Okay.
If that makes sense, I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, no,
it's,
it does.
It's hard to...
No, I think it makes sense.
It's hard to describe exactly every situation. So.
Okay, thank you. Wondering if Randy could comment on that. Randy? Okay.
I think there's a misunderstanding. We're not saying you can't stock a pond on a natural stream channel. There's a process that would go through to protect native species. The problem with anybody looking at a piece of property where the water originates and terminates on that piece of property at the time you're there doesn't account for high runoff, you know, high water in the spring. And what we're asking is an opportunity to go look at it and evaluate the threat downstream or potentially upstream when there might be connectivity. We've done that in a number of cases and allowed these stockings to take place in the past and will in the future. The COR process is our way of just evaluating the risk.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, my situation is that in the spring, summer, the water flows into there, flows out into another area that it fills up. By the end of the summer, that area is completely dry. There's no outflow from our pond. That must not have been a problem because they did issue me a core several years ago to do that without screens. So it was all contained. So anyway.
So one of the other things about this rule change that just needs to be addressed or brought up is the fact that with this change, in the last, 8 years, state regulation has been that we were trying to get away from CORs and trying to allow people to be able to purchase fish. For example, if you want to buy a chicken, you go buy a chicken. But if you want to buy fish, there's some other things you have to go through. And we're trying to streamline that so that if somebody wants to buy a fish, they can buy a fish. And with the new current rule or the rule that's being proposed, we do like all of the additions that they're doing. It is going to require a lot more CORs at this point. Does that make sense? So.
Any other comments?
The stream comes off of Forest Service land, which is, you know, like 100 yards through the fence before the private property, goes into a pond that's used for irrigation, which I have the water filings on, and it's a small stream. I think the water filing is for a little bit less than 1 second foot of water. But the water, unless it was a real runoff spring flood, never leaves the private property. Like you say, there's always a natural course, and you can see where, you know, in certain times water would run to the river, but it would be a mile away. And so, you know, I'm just trying to get in my mind whether this is the kind of thing you would say that maybe wouldn't need a COR in this case. Yeah, and I agree with that. If that's we can do that, and I'm sure there's lots of other smaller ponds like that, because the pond is used, you know, to store the water, you know, until you got enough to irrigate and flood with and stuff like that. I'm currently in the process of trying to put a pivot out of it so that I use it, but I would like to. As far as I know, it's never had fish in it. It's never been stocked or anything, but in my mind, I would love to be able to put fish in there and create.
That's all we're asking. Is we want to allow more people to create fish, just like Randy stated at the beginning. Our business and what they do is to promote people fishing and promote that opportunity.
Yeah, and I would certainly think that would be good if we could help that.
How many CORs are turned down for this kind of? I mean, do you ever turn people down?
To say that it's infrequent is an understatement. We work with the landowners and private aquaculture through most issues, whether it's, you know, putting screens in or a different species of fish. Those seem to be the two most common things. The reason that some of these changes are being recommended is. And Robert kind of alluded to this. Historically, you know, there have been ponds that you'd argue either way. And, you know, to try and define what a natural stream channel is problematic because of springs, you know, where it ends, you know. So it's more about the threat. And so we're trying to get away from, you know, from historic decisions and try and get to a good happy spot. But usually... And Robert might be able to, you know, comment on this too. Usually we work through the issues through a series of phone calls between private aquaculture ourselves, regional managers, and the landowner.
Drew, while you're right there, so with these new proposals, complete change of what we've had in the past, does that make it a lot easier for the CORs to be put into place, or makes it a lot easier for people to be able to handle fish?
It makes it a lot easier to understand the rule. There were two, now there's one. It simplifies the process that it goes through. It allows for some stocking in places where historically they couldn't take place at all. according to rule. And so what we've done is moved those into a situation where we would evaluate them on a case-by-case basis. And there should be more opportunity for, private stocking through this rule. I don't think anything's ever perfect, but we've worked with Robert since on, a variety of different rule changes and his group since 2008, I believe, and have, adjusted things on a continual basis since then, addressing issues as they arise as we can.
From the aquaculture side of things, we agree that there are parts of this rule that allows more people to access fish, but we also believe that through the way that it's written currently with the natural stream channel thing, that will require more COR. So they still have the ability to get fish, they would just have to go through the COR process before they could get the fish. Does that make sense?
No,
question. The COR process, is that
is it that big of a deal to get a COR? I mean, are you turning away people because they don't have a COR? Because the division isn't getting them fast enough, or there's not enough resources? Help me understand what the big deal about getting a COR is.
Well, it depends on your perspective. Does that make sense? And so we hear it from our customers. I want a lot of fish, and they want maybe 50 fish. And that's going to cost them maybe $50 or $100, but to get a COR is going to cost them $200. So for them, they look at it as cost prohibitive.
So it's a cost issue.
Yeah, because the division charges for them to go out and inspect that facility to verify.
Okay, that makes sense.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that.
It just depends on the buyer. Some buyers, $200, it's no big deal. Other people think it is a big deal. So it's just dependent.
So the question that I have now then is, who determines whether you need the COR? Does the aquaculture folks do it?
It's within the rule. Yeah. So if those three criteria are met, so if you have sterile fish, you have a screened pond, and what was the third one, Randy? Not on natural stream channel, then you can stock ponds without a COR.
So if I go to someone that raises fish, and I go to them and I say, hey, I want to buy some fish, and how you take them up to this pond on my property, what's he going to say to me?
He's going to look at the screen, or is it on a natural stream channel? Has it got a screen, and are you stocking the right fish? And he can address most of that over a phone call with you, and I think Robert does a really good job at that.
Well, who?
Yeah. It's hard for us at times to make that decision because we don't know. We're over a phone. So that's why what I propose that you do it where if it wells up on their property, they would be able to stock it. It eliminates a lot of the questions.
So I can see now for me, for an example, this becomes problematic now. Even though before I had a cord and was able to buy, it cost me, $25 or something for that cord at that point. This rule makes it more questionable as to whether I should go get a core or not, or whether I need one.
It actually makes it less questionable.
Really?
Yeah. You just agreed. It actually simplifies this process for Robert and for you, because we created an app that I'm not a smartphone savvy guy, but I can operate it, and I can get on there and say, okay, you have a pond right here.
Okay.
And I can get on there, and it's a Google Earth app, and I can expand out and say, I see your pond. Here's what you need to do. Here's what you can stock. Here are your requirements.
Okay. So that's really the resource to go to
yep.
to make that help yep. make that determination.
That's right.
Okay.
The only thing that makes it a little harder is that natural stream channel saying that you can't stock in a natural stream channel. But other than that, the fact that if you have screens and you use the right sterility of the fish, that makes it much simpler for us.
Dan.
Yeah, let me respond, Alan. So the flip side of the coin, though, however, is a pond that I was familiar with down in just outside of Beaver that had Sacramento perch in it. and it was on a natural stream channel? I don't think so. It was very small. Most of the year there was no water running in it, so you know, you'd say, oh, it's fine. But then we had a catastrophic thunderstorm. Water topped the dam. Sacramento perch ended up in Minersville Reservoir, and I don't know how much we paid to eradicate the Sacramento perch in Minersville Reservoir, but it was a lot of money to buy that. So I'm just saying that the flip side of the coin is that there are consequences to, you know, aquaculture. I'm an aquaculturist, have been all my life, but I'm just saying that there are consequences that we pay sometimes, even when we think we're doing all of the right things, you know. And so that's why we pay these guys to go look at those ponds and at least on Google, right, and take a look and see, you know, is there a potential for trouble here? And so the species, the drainage, the, you know, the screening or whatever it might take, is the dam secure? You know, is it going to go out in a thunderstorm or something like that? Those things are all extremely important, and you would agree.
I would agree, but okay. What we're talking about mostly, I would agree with you, but what we're talking about mostly, it is salmonid fish, so fish that are in the salmon family. You bring up a perch situation, that would have had to have been approved by the division. So it would have had to have been approved by them.
But, by the way, that's not a perch. It's a sunfish.
Okay, Alan?
Well, in this list that you've got here at the end, it says that fertile rainbow trout may be stocked without a COR in any private fish pond or short-term fishing event within the state consistent with the rule except for, and then it gives all the waters of the state, it looks like to me. Because there's page after page, and Duchesne County is where mine is the drainage. Mine's in Wasatch County, but it drains into Duchesne County. You know, that's the whole water drainage. So with no COR, where can you put fertile rainbow trout?
Once again, the rule has basically, you know, two questions as far as where you can put rainbow trout, where you can't. Statewide, if you have those, if you meet those three requirements on that schematic, and we might pull that up again. If your pond meets those three things to the left, so those three things up top, then anywhere in the state you can stock sterile salmonid trout. It minus brown trout in the Virgin River area.
Right, but so, my question was, without a COR.
Yes, without a COR.
You can't do it.
You can. As long as your pond meets those first three, and you stock sterile salmonid, so sterile browns, sterile brook, tiger trout, sterile rainbows, you don't need a COR to do that. There are places, though, out in the, you know, like the Wasatch Front down below 7,000 feet in the Colorado River drainage, where you can stock fertile rainbow trout without a COR, as long as you meet those first three things. And that's where that phone app, you know, helps Robert make that decision.
Thanks.
A lot of times we have a heart... We have heart-to-hearts all the time, and sometimes we disagree. But I'll tell you that the hooks look really confusing, and they're extremely hard to understand. The little app on the phone will make it a much easier opportunity for people to understand. The hooks is just a way that they're able to identify a stream that they have a situation with. But generally speaking, if you're in a valley location along from the Wasatch Front down south, you can stock with diploid fish. It's once you get up into the mountain areas, once you start up into those areas where there are native fishes that they're concerned about, that's when you would be required to use sterils. Does that make sense? It's a lot more open than it seems based on those hooks. Does that make sense or not?
Well, right now it's probably all a little confusing to me because it looks like to me I would love to make a motion to meet what you're saying, but I don't know how I would word it to make it a little less stringent so that you didn't have to have a COR in
broader circumstances than what it is now. But I don't know how to word the thing, so I don't.
Any other comments, any discussion?
Richard.
Okay.
Dan brought up an excellent point. At some point, I think this COR is to protect the native fish, other waterways. It's just, it's something there to catch something that might happen in the future. So, you know, there's got to be some regulation. And I think they're making it a little easier for the fish industry. And so I make a motion to accept the recommendation as proposed.
Okay. I have a motion and a second by Dan. Call for a vote on this. All in favor of the proposal as presented? It's unanimous in favor. Okay. Thanks for the discussion. Larry made the motion. Dan Potts was the second. Okay, so we have Nathan Owens, AIS rule amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Owens. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. I'm here to present on a few proposed rule changes to Rule R657-60, the Aquatic Invasive Species Rule. Before I jump into some of these rule changes, I'd just like to provide a little bit of background on our program. Currently, we have two mussel-affected waters within the state of Utah. First, obviously, is Lake Powell, which is classified as an infested water, meaning there are multiple age classes and a reproducing population there. We also have Deer Creek Reservoir here along the Wasatch Front that's classified as a suspect water, meaning that there was a single water sample collected back, it was 2 years ago now, that tested positive for larval quagga mussels. No further evidence there has suggested that there is a mussel population there, but both at Lake Powell and at Deer Creek Reservoir, we currently have containment programs in place, making sure no adult mussels or potentially contaminated water are leaving those reservoirs. 2016 was kind of a unique situation for us. We started seeing things that we hadn't seen before, and probably the best indicator of that was the fact that we saw over 50 mussel-encrusted boats just within this last season, compared to 2015, when we saw a grand total of about 15. So things really escalated this last year, and these proposed rule changes are going to put us in a much better position to deal with kind of what the future challenges are looking like, and will hopefully improve the experience of the boating community. The first rule change is we would like to institute a mandatory dry time requirement in addition to a professional decontamination for all boats found to have mussels attached to them. The way our current rule reads, you could have a boat pull out of Lake Powell with, you know, potentially 100 mussels attached to it and have a 3-4 hour decontamination done through hot water wash and then immediately come up and launch at Jordanelle Reservoir. We don't feel like that is sufficient to protect our waters. Some of our recent experiences this last year, especially at our I-15 port of entry, show that this is probably a good move and a good secondary layer of protection. We've had boats show up from Lake Mead that have had professional decontaminations done at Lake Mead, had mussels attached, and we could not verify that those mussels, when they showed up in St. George, were actually dead. Secondly, there's a lot of talk about contaminated water and the potential to move larval mussels or veligers through ballast tank water and residual water in some of these systems. While that is a very serious threat, we also have to realize that when veligers start growing in the water, they have to settle out as adults and be within 12 to 18 inches of them of each other to successfully reproduce. Some of these bigger boats that have attached mussels, these are adult mussels. You're essentially moving a full colony of mussels ready to start reproducing as soon as they hit the water. So that's another threat that we need to be concerned about. Third is we would have this mandatory dry time coincide with the seasonal dry time requirement we already have in place. So for summer, June, July, August, that's 7 days. During the fall and spring months, those are 18 days. And then during the winter, those are 30 days. Please keep in mind that this will only likely apply to boats that are sitting in mussel-infested waters like Lake Powell for extended periods of time. So you're talking weeks, if not months. This would not affect most boats that are coming and going for a long weekend. The second rule change we'd like to propose has to do with one rule that's currently in place, and that is a rule that requires all boats exiting an infested water body to completely drain that watercraft before leaving the immediate area. We would like to add a requirement onto that and make it mandatory that all drain plugs and other devices that retain water be removed from the watercraft during transport. The reason we're proposing this is we have our technicians on the ramps at Lake Powell, and they're doing a great job of inspecting boats and draining those boats of all water they can before that boat exits. We also conduct mandatory inspection stations and administrative checkpoints down on the highway outside of Lake Powell. What we are starting to see is sometimes when our technicians at the ramp verify that that boat has been drained of water, as soon as that boat is trailered and moves around on the trailer on the highway, 6 miles down the road, we pop that plug again. You know, sometimes there's a gallon, 2 gallons of water come out. So it's just the movement of the boat on the trailer will tend to free up some of that water. A plug that's removed during transport will allow us to make sure that that water is not being transported. And a simple, you know, 2 or 3 minute inspection of the boat ramp is not what we're relying on to make sure that water is not being transported out of the immediate area. I would like to point out that this is something that the entire Western U.S. has agreed on. So pretty much every Western state is pursuing this exact same rule change either this year or planning to pursue it in the immediate future. So this would put us in line with what the rest of the Western United States is trying to do in this issue. The third rule change, it's kind of a housekeeping rule change. We'd like to propose that we remove Colorado from the list of infested water bodies. Colorado is fairly similar to Utah in the sense that back in 2007-2008, they had a series of 4 reservoirs test positive for quagga mussel larvae. We had the same thing happen with Electric Lake and Red Fleet. Further testing, both here and in Colorado, has not yielded any further evidence of mussels in those reservoirs. And their last listed water body, Pueblo Reservoir, is being delisted this winter. So by the start of next boating season, Colorado will not have any listed water bodies, positive or otherwise. So we recommend that we remove Colorado from that infested list. This would do a whole lot in terms of working towards reciprocity with that state, because it would be like essentially Colorado treating every boat from Utah as having been to Lake Powell, regardless of where they're coming from. The fourth and final rule change we're proposing is the inclusion of quarantine language under R657-60-11, which pertains to the conveyance or equipment detainment. This would allow some of our conservation officers to restrict watercraft from launching without actually taking possession of that watercraft from the boat owner. So this would actually tie into that first proposed rule change very well, in that it gives our officers the flexibility to say, okay, your boat had mussels attached to it. Now you've received the professional decontamination, but we still cannot allow you to launch. However, we will allow you to transport your boat back to your place of residence, and we'll just make sure that it remains dry there. Helps our officers out. They don't have to find a safe place to store this boat for the required dry time. They don't have to do inventories of all the possessions, and it helps the boat owner out in the sense that they get to remain in possession of the boat and not basically have their vacation ruined by having their boat stay at Lake Powell when they come back up to the Wasatch Front. So with that, thank you, and I can take any questions you may have.
Okay, thanks, Nathan. Any questions from the RAC? Dan?
Yeah, that BYU football helmet.
That's the one.
Was there motive?
Is there any muscles attached to that?
I'll just tell you that out of Utah State, BYU and Utah State lost that muscle battle. They had the most muscles attached after a year. So okay. Take that what you will.
Any questions?
I got a question for you. So we have an officer that stops a boat on the road. He puts the cable on that boat and sends the guy on his way. What stops that guy from taking out some bolt cutters and cutting off that cable and go fishing?
Good question. So just to clarify, that last proposed rule change, we already have that authority under statute. This is mostly just to clarify it within the rule. We have done this, I'd say probably between 5 and 10 times this last year. What we end up doing is we instruct the boat owner, hey, you are restricted from launching your boat for this amount of time. Once you get back to your place of residence, we will contact you, or you are instructed to contact one of our conservation officers. They will come over to your place of residence, apply that seal, and we will periodically check in on that boat, make sure that boat has not been moved, that seal has not been broken during that required dry time. So we are currently doing that, and it has worked pretty well.
And that's just for vessels that have an attached, that won't change for the weekend guy that goes down there, cleans his boat up, drains his boat up, and has to dry it in the summer for 7 days.
Correct. This will not apply to probably 99% of the boats visiting Lake Powell. It's just another precautionary thing we can do to make sure that the highest risk boats and those with attached muscles go through the required process to make sure they're not posing an additional risk.
Okay. Any questions from the audience? Any comments? You can then bring it back to the board. Any comments? What's your pleasure?
Bruce. I'd like to make a motion that we accept the rule amendment as presented.
Okay, I have a motion. I have a second on that. George, second the motion. Okay. Call for a vote on that. All in favor? Okay, vote unanimous. Okay. Okay, thank you. I think you do a good job. I'm glad to see that on top of this, and nobody wants these waters messed up, so good job. Okay, Brian Christensen, dedicated hunter rule.
All right. All right. My name is Brian Christensen. I am the state coordinator for volunteer services and the dedicated hunter program. I appreciate this opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members of the RAC. The dedicated hunter program has been a program that we run that gives, for those maybe less familiar with it, gives general season buck deer hunters an opportunity to hunt 3 years. Let's see, there we go. Three years in a row, all three seasons, the archery, muzzleloader, and rifle season, or the any legal weapon season as we call it, in exchange for 32 hours worth of division approved service, the completion of an educational course, and an agreement to only take 2 deer in a 3-year time frame. So this is something that's been going since about 1996. We currently have about 8,000, it's just barely underneath 8,000 dedicated hunter participants, and applications to be enrolled in this program are taken annually during the big game application drawing period. So that's kind of a little background over the program. The next, what we're doing here today essentially is to update some of the wording within the rule and tie it to existing statute or other rules. In some cases, tie it to the rule itself, just keep consistency there. We made a good attempt to clarify some things that were assumed or just not as clearly stated as they could be. We also tried to simplify it and then specifically address a few common requests that we would get from dedicated hunters, and at the same time improve some of our own internal administrative procedures to just make it easier to run the program. So for the portion on clarification, there's a license requirement to in statute that somebody has to have a hunting or combination license to be issued a big game permit. Within the rule, we clarify it so that if somebody applies for a permit or a dedicated hunter COR, they have to have the hunting license or combination license. And that just hadn't been stated in the previous rule. We also clarify that they have to have that permit, the combination or hunting license at the time that we issue, basically print out their second and third year permits. That just hadn't been issued or hadn't been written in the previous rule. It was just assumed because it is part of statute. We found this to be a good clarification. The next part there, use appropriate hunting tackle or firearm. We felt it necessary after receiving questions or just a number of folks wanting clarity to actually state that you must use archery tackle during the archery season, muzzleloaders during muzzleloader season, and then any legal weapon during that season, and just have it written within the rule. And then the last part there, we didn't ever say when they had to take their conservation ethics course. We just assumed that once you were enrolled, that was the appropriate time. Now this rule suggestion says once you've enrolled, once you join, then after that time frame is the appropriate time to take this training course. Simple things, but should help out for resolving some prior questions and confusion. As far as simplification goes, we added a section in here. The current rule allows residents to purchase up to 24 of the 32 service hours, and non-residents can purchase all 32. We've had enough requests and experience to just write it in to make that even for both residents and non-residents alike. We also have been accepting, within the current rule, donations of approved materials to the division for projects and other things. And we found that many of the residents purchasing up to the 24 were donating their other 8 in materials. And so to them, it's really the same thing. This just makes it simpler all around. We've consolidated the suspension provisions. Many of those were already stated in statute. And the rest of them, looking at the rule that we've changed, pushes them to the back, so it's all in one spot rather than 2 or 3 different places. Then we simplified some options for the military as well. Our current rule had a number of opportunities, options for military personnel that get deployed or mobilized, and we found many gray areas, different situations with different terms of deployment, and we've simplified this to basically say if they are mobilized or deployed for at least a consecutive 3-month period within their dedicated hunter enrollment, they can request a 1-year extension, and they just won't go hunting that year, but we'll just tack on a 4th year. They're still required to do all the same requirements for service hours. The 2 deer maximum harvest limit is still the same. This just offers them that opportunity to move 1 year out. The same thing would be offered if they're deployed or mobilized during the hunting season. And that happens frequently where they get all their service hours done and then they get the letter in the mail that says you're deployed during all the hunts. So this would alleviate some of those issues. As far as administrative changes that we had, written into this proposal, it would be to allow a one-year extension, and this one comes directly from requests from dedicated hunters and the public. If somebody in these circumstances, having been a recipient of a poaching reported rewards permit, or having drawn a limited entry deer tag from the big game drawing. Now that excludes other means of obtaining limited entry deer tags. This is very specific to those two things, the poaching reported rewards permit or the limited entry deer tag from the big game drawing. If they're in those two scenarios and they're a dedicated hunter, we would offer them the opportunity to accept a one-year extension of their program. Instead of the current rule, if they draw one of those tags or obtain one of those tags, it just eats up their dedicated 100 year. So they end up with 2 years of their three. The changes we also have are to modify a signature requirement. Right now, you have to sign the piece of paper that we send you. And we'd like to we wrote this so that we could open up the possibility of being paperless on the CORs, the certificate of registrations, in the future. Then to remove the service hour exemption for participants being relocated for educational religious purposes. So the current rule basically gave anybody that had some educational endeavor or religious endeavor that was going to be gone for a minimum period of 1 year within their 3-year enrollment, it waived their annual requirements, but they didn't get to hunt. And what we found was that with so many different kinds of educational endeavors or religious endeavors, very few of them actually fit that full 1 year time frame within their CORs. And it just wasn't a very helpful rule, despite its intent. So what we've proposed is to remove that entirely, but make it easier for all kinds of life scenarios, life situations, to withdraw from the program, depending on their circumstances. So I'll go into that here on this next slide. The current rule says that you can surrender or withdraw. Surrender is our key word for it, but essentially it's a withdrawal from the program. Current rule says if you have zero permits issued during your 3-year time frame, then you don't need any hours. You can sign a formal surrender form and be withdrawn from the program with no strings attached. If you had one permit issued, you'd have to have 10 hours, sign the form, and then you could be withdrawn from the program. It also allows some provisions for injuries or illness or death for those withdrawals, but we don't change those in this proposal because those are subject to a whole different rule. Our recommendation is that if somebody has zero permits issued and 0 hours, they can withdraw at any time during the 3 years just by signing a surrender form, just to say, let me out. If they have one permit, they need 11 hours, and we change that because it's a little more consistent with a third of the program, you know, being 32, we put it to 11. If they had two permits, they would need a minimum of 22 hours complete, and they could still surrender. Now, the hitch is that if they've had two permits and they have two deer harvests, they cannot surrender out because they've been able to get the full benefit. And so two deer permits, two deer taken, you're in for the third year no matter what. Okay, and then down at the bottom there, I made a note that if they had excess hours, let's say they had 30 hours done and no permits issued during that time frame, those 30 hours are still only applicable to that 3-year COR. We're not going to forward those into future years. It's only applicable to that time frame. That's what I have for you.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Okay, I have a couple of questions. I've had some emails and personal visits, and they wondered if there was any interest from the RAC or the Wildlife Board in allowing dedicated hunters to attend RAC or Wildlife Board meetings and get our service hours applied.
As are you asking if someone was back here ending the meeting, just
meeting,
watching the meeting,
obviously have to sign a role, et cetera, you know, information to get part of those hours that way.
Right. I'll answer that with two answers. The first one is that we, as dedicated hunters, we used to have a requirement to attend at least one RAC meeting. And that became problematic in a number of ways. And so to force a dedicated hunter to be here and participate wasn't helpful in every case. And I'm seeing some some agreement here.
Yeah, like there were 200 people there in the audience.
Yeah. So the second part of my answer is that we don't have any intention of allowing dedicated hunters to participate as an audience member and earn their service credit. We feel that this program should have them actively out doing service projects. To be here as an audience member is important, and so I don't shun their request for that. But I would feel that to participate is an important thing that a deer hunter or a dedicated hunter ought to do, regardless of earning service credit for those hours.
One of the complaints that I've been hearing is the fact that sometimes there are times when projects are far and few between for certain areas, mm-hmm. and it's hard to get some of those service hours in. And so that was just maybe another option that might be available for them to participate. So
I appreciate that comment too. I guess I agree. In some locations in the state, there will be fewer deer projects. I like to use Salt Lake City as an example. We don't try to grow too many deer in Salt Lake, but hit the mountains and now you're going to find more. So I agree. In some places in Utah, it will be more challenging to find continual abundant projects. Where we find the dedicated hunters are most successful is if they go to our website, look at the projects a couple of times a week, rather than once or twice a month, because many of those projects that are close by to their residencies fill up very quick, and they're only announced for a day or two, or maybe a very short period of time. So they just won't see those projects if they only look once a month or every couple of months.
Okay. Yep. Another question I've been approached about too is: have you ever considered? I think was brought up in the Wildlife Board meeting last time is. Structuring some type of a dedicated hunter program for elk, general elk.
Right.
Are you working on that? We
have discussed that at length. I've met with Justin and several of the big game biologists, and we've talked about a variety of ways in which that could occur. If it ever did come to be a formal program, it would be a whole separate rule. It would be its own entity and be run that way. Initially, I can tell you that through several discussions, we feel that to make a successful program for elk, we would probably have to either limit the number of people in there dramatically, or we would have to change the way we arrange projects, because now we would have two competing programs for volunteer service, which would mean similar habitat types, similar projects, and now competition between two different types of hunters for those same projects. And so we'd have to be pretty creative there. So one of the things that has been discussed, but again, there's not been any formal decisions made, is that, the potential of a different kind of hunting permit altogether that wasn't tied to service, that might provide the same opportunities that those folks are hoping for.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, any questions from the board on this? I have to say, though, I've done projects through George's office, through the Forest Service, for my dedicated 100 hours, as well as some of my sons, and they're always willing to find a project to help. So if you're up against the wall, that's a good place to go. So.
I would agree. You probably don't want to do projects for horses or ATVs, so that's probably true, George.
I was going to say, yeah, but they grow more horses.
You know, Brian, I have something too. I'm just wondering, you know, I was trying to do the definition, and I know we want to get close.
You know, out doing wildlife projects, but what about wildlife education? Because I know we have a wildlife module for our Diamond Fork Youth Forest, and you know, kids go out there and participate in that youth forest program. And a lot of times with decreased staff, I mean, our staff numbers are going down. There's going to be a point where we're going to have volunteers out there teaching the kids and stuff. So would that qualify?
You know, with every project, we entertain every proposal for projects, independent projects or partnered projects with agencies. And what we initially do is we'll ask a few basic questions. And one is, what is this doing for wildlife? Or what is it doing for wildlife habitat, you know, specifically in Utah? And then what is it doing for access, public access to wildlife and wildlife recreation? And wildlife recreation being several things, you know. So if it answers those questions favorably, then generally we can create a project out of it. Absolutely. So we would encourage you to present that project to us. You know, for the central region, it would be contacting Derek Murdoch and discussing that project option with him. So we look at a few of those criteria, and if we feel like it's in tandem with the Dedicated Hunter Program and its intentions, the Division of Wildlife, and our goals and mission, then you got a pretty good project. The details after that are deciding, you know, who is it that we would have, you know, and making sure that the right kinds of people, the right kinds of volunteers are paired up and recruited for that particular project.
Okay, thank you.
Richard.
Yes.
I want to put Mike back in the game here. There's a huge potential for hours, and I don't know if it would qualify, but just out through these, you're not Salt Lake anymore, but out through this desert, the BLM, of just debris and garbage from the shooters. You know, there's a huge ton of hours. And if that would qualify, that would help everything in that country.
So. I agree, Larry. We need to do a better job on our end to try to get some projects. And I'll take that back to both the Salt Lake and Fillmore office, and we'll rededicate ourselves to come back with some more projects. So I agree. Yeah. Fillmore's clean. Yeah. No, we need to do better. Thanks, Larry. Yeah, you're right.
So Larry, I can add one thing to that. I don't know about the Utah County side. I know we have some projects running for that very thing, west of Utah Lake. We work with, is it Patricia? No, Patricia's, tell me, yes, with Roxanne T. We work with her and some of her folks, and we've done several cleanups, from basically Skull Valley all the way down to the southern portion of Utah Lake towards Goshen. And those projects have often brought 50, 60 volunteers in a day. And the first time we ran a big, big one was last year, and we took out 120 commercial, you know, 6-foot bags of garbage out of one area, and went back this year. And we were very, very happy with how little we actually brought back out. So I appreciate you bringing that up. BLM's been a great partner. Definitely room for growth with trigger trash and hunt, shooting sports responsibility. So, yeah, we'll expand that.
Okay. Any other questions from the board? Questions from the audience?
DJ Bigler, representing the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. Brian, I've been the coordinator from SFW in this Utah County Central Region area for probably 20 years now. I've dealt with Katie Koppel, Derek Murdoch,
Joe Proctor. I've gone through five or six from the Central Region office. And this will be the 11th year that I've been at the expo. And we get dedicated hunter hours for the guys that have been running that 200 permit booth out there for the state's 200 permits that they draw for the $5 application fee. In years past, the men that have worked in that booth got as many as 24 hours during the week. They'd be there all week. This year, Derek says we're going to drop that to a maximum of 12 hours. It's going to be awful hard to get the guys to fill that booth. There has to be 8 guys in that booth for 10 and a half hours a day for those 4 days. And once they get 12 hours, they're not going to come out there. And since that booth, to apply for those 200 permits, you need a state hunting license or a combination license to apply, and that's non-residents and residents. So that benefits the division buying the licenses, and then the $5 application fee benefits SFW and the Mule Deer Foundation. So that could be a fundraiser for us. And I'll agree with the 12 hours maximum for a fundraiser, but where we're trying to get 8 guys for 10 and a half hours a day in that booth, I'd like to see you make an exception on that just for the expo, because the money raised benefits the state quite a bit too.
Thank you. Okay, any other comments, questions? No. Okay, bring it back to the board.
Just one more comment. The Salt Lake County Fish and Game Association, one of the organizations that I represent, has utilized dedicated hunters at the Utah Lake Festival for years. And as Chris and Scott know, it's been incredibly invaluable because we just don't have the people to be able to take that on. And, that positively influences things that are so far from deer, it's ridiculous. I mean, we're talking about, this extremely big, shallow lake and shallower now. I just think that those dedicated hunters keep coming back year after year after year because they're having so much fun, and yet they're so helpful for the June Sucker Recovery Program and also for the Utah Lake a commission, etc. I just can't say enough good things about that, the opportunities that you guys provide. So, thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
Richard, I'll go ahead and make a motion to accept the dedicated hunter rule amendments as proposed.
Okay. We have a motion. Second. Larry, second. Okay, we'll call for a vote. All in favor? Okay, voting's unanimous. Okay. Thank you for all participating. We'll see the Wildlife Board Friday.